In 2011, the San Francisco Symphony celebrates its 100th season. Since 1925, the orchestra has been making recordings. I'm Scott Fogelsong, a contributing writer and pre-concert lecturer here at the Symphony. For some years now, I've been exploring the Symphony's long and distinguished history and recorded sound, a vast treasure of music preserved in commercial recordings, in radio broadcasts, and from the Symphony's own archives. I invite you to join me in these podcasts as I share some of my favorite moments drawn from 85 years of great recordings by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. On this podcast, the Joseph Cripps era from 1963 to 1970, a time of tremendous change and growth for the Symphony. The sound of the San Francisco Symphony under Joseph Cripps has been, until recently, terra incognita to all but those people who were actually there at the concerts, or who tuned in to KKHI for the Friday night broadcasts that began on November 29, 1963. The orchestra made no commercial recordings during this period. Therefore, our oral documentation has depended on those dedicated listeners who recorded the KKHI broadcasts off-air, and who kept those recordings safe during the 40-plus years that separate us from this era. I'd like to thank two collectors in particular for sharing these musical riches with us: Dr. Harrietta Cripps, widow of Joseph Cripps, and Arthur Bloomfield, well-known San Francisco writer and former music critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Their contributions have opened a door to a nearly vanished era in the Symphony's recorded history. Joseph Cripps' inaugural concert was on November 29, 1963, just a week after the JFK assassination. Fortunately, it has been captured for posterity thanks to a dedicated listener with a tape recorder. The program: Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, Richard Strauss's Don Juan, and the Brahms' First Symphony. The message was unmistakable. We're going to be playing meat and potatoes repertory now. The concert heralded a new era at the Symphony. Joseph Cripps would transform the orchestra. By the time Cripps left in 1970, the San Francisco Symphony would be in superb shape and ready for the next era. Cripps did not arrive at the Symphony like Yosemite Sam, with guns blazing and threatening to clean up the joint. Instead, he made his changes, and there were many, gradually. Many new conductors change an orchestra's concertmaster. In this case, after the 1963-64 season, Cripps replaced the Symphony's current concertmaster, Frank Hauser. Hauser had been with the Symphony for a long time. He was originally hired by Pierre Monteux in 1935, part of the group of musicians brought on board to revitalize the orchestra after the near-death experience of 1934. He sat second to concertmaster Noam Blinder, and when Blinder retired in 1957, Hauser became the concertmaster. Due to the paucity of recordings from the Horda era, we have only a few examples of Hauser's work as concertmaster. First of all, here he is in a brief but very difficult passage from Andrew Imbrie's Legend, recorded on CRI with Horda conducting. The Brahms' First Symphony was featured on Cripps' inaugural concert. Thus, Hauser played the signature violin solo passage in the second movement. For the purposes of comparison, here is the passage played by Noam Blinder during a standard hour broadcast from December 23, 1951, with Pierre Monteux conducting. That's just vintage Blinder. outward, soloistic, almost as though he's playing a concerto rather than a solo passage within a symphony. Here is Hauser's performance of the same passage from the Crypt's inaugural concert. You can hear that Hauser is much less soloistic than Blender, more part of the fabric. Perhaps Hauser might seem less technically assured than Blender, but one should never make broad judgments based on a single passage from a live performance. Cripps replaced Hauser with Jacob Krakmalnik, and Hauser then returned a second chair, as he had been during Blender's tenure. Krakmalnik was a veteran of numerous orchestras, having been assistant concertmaster in the Cleveland Orchestra and then concertmaster in both the Philadelphia and Amsterdam Concertgebouw orchestras. Krakmalnik was a demanding concertmaster and was generally disliked by his colleagues for his autocratic style and sarcastic, even harsh, criticisms of the strings. But he was a whale of a violinist, technically precise, with a hall-filling tone, and capable of really remarkable expressivity. Consider this performance of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto from a broadcast of March 12, 1965, with Cripps conducting. We have only hearsay on the subject of Krakmalnik's abrasiveness, but a sense of his unfortunate propensity for tactlessness emerges in this interview from February 17, 1967, in which he has some very choice words to say about his former maestro, George Zell.
Now, on the other hand, take Mr. Zell, who is not a German, but who in his attitude and behaviors characterizes what you have in your mind from all the war movies of a typical Prussian, prison warden.
He makes new music, too.
Oh, he...
Change swept the first chair positions throughout the orchestra. Among the most notable were the changes in the woodwinds, particularly oboe and clarinet. The somewhat nasal sound of Monteux's San Francisco Symphony soon became a thing of the past. Oboist Mark Lifshey came to the symphony in 1965 from the Cleveland Orchestra, where he had been principal. For his first 5 years, he was co-principal with Jean-Louis Leroux, becoming full principal in 1970, and remaining at the symphony until 1986. Mark's exquisite sound is no better demonstrated than this performance of the Schubert Ninth Symphony, broadcast on December 6, 1968, with Cripps conducting. Clarinetist Robert McGinnis was another Cripps era addition. He served as co-principal to Philip Fath from 1964 through 1969, after having served for many years as the New York Philharmonic's principal. Here we hear him playing the clarinet solo in Weber's Overture to Oberon. We are very fortunate in having some multiple versions of works that reflect changes in the orchestra's overall sound over the span of the Crips era. Consider Paul Hindemith's Matisse Gemahler, broadcast first in 1964, then in 1968. First, we note that the 1964 orchestra has a somewhat more brassy, a sort of a wind-strong kind of sound. It's a very, very good sound, without a doubt. Word here about making audio comparisons. In the case of these two performances, keep in mind that the audio quality between the two is notably different. In the 1968 version we're about to hear, the microphone placement is farther away from the orchestra, and the overall frequency range is really slanted more towards the mid-range frequencies. But with that allowance, we can hear that the orchestral sound is much more full-bodied. It allows for the brass to be part of the overall texture rather than dominating it, as it had in the 1964 performance. This really does demonstrate one of Cripps' singular changes in the orchestra, which was a move to a much more homogeneous body of sound. And yes, that is Cripps vocalizing to the orchestra for some of the big downbeats. Sometimes he would sing or grunt like that. Other times, he produced a kind of a shushing sound like this. Here's one of my favorite such moments at the very end of the third movement of the Dvorak New World Symphony. He stamps his foot, he goes yeah to the orchestra, and then he flips the score page ahead right in the same mood. Turn the page. Next up, I have two renditions of Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier Suite. I find these two performances to be particularly fascinating, given that the second one was made somewhat after Cripps' tenure, when he appeared as a guest emeritus conductor. So first, March 3, 1965. Here we have a wonderful, bright passion to the thing, complete with one of those marvelous Cripps sound effects. Now, on April the 8th, 1972, we hear the same passage, with precisely the same tempo, but with a more cushioned and richer sound, allowing, as always, for a somewhat different-sounding recording. Here, we have no Cripps vocalizing, alas. matter what orchestra he was leading, Joseph Krips showed certain overriding characteristics as a conductor. Let's take a look at a few of those characteristics. First of all, Krips's choice of tempi. He tended to shy away from the extremes, preferring tempi that gave the music abundant opportunity to breathe. Consider his Beethoven Fifth, broadcast on December 7th, 1966. Without question, Krips was an architect of orchestral sound. He loved creating a big, lush, beautiful sound that blended strings, winds, brass, and percussion into one wonderful wash. Consider this performance of the overture to Wagner's Tannhäuser from December 6, 1968, in which the brass soloists are heard over but don't necessarily dominate the body of strings. There was nothing emotionally restrained or cautious about Joseph Krips. He could take a passionate outburst in the orchestra almost to the point at which the music seems to explode. Consider the final pages of his 1972 Rosenkavalier Suite, surely one of the most unrestrained performances imaginable.
Thank you.
Given his reputation for being an exemplar of the great Viennese classical tradition, one wouldn't think of Cripps as having much sympathy for 20th century music, but that would be an error. He possessed a surprising flair for newer works, never more beautifully expressed than in this stunning performance of the Walton First Symphony, broadcast on January the 10th, 1964. I think that Maestro Cripps should have the final words for this podcast. Here he offers us some thoughts about listening to music freely and happily, advice that is just as pertinent today as it was on December 7th, 1966, when he is interviewed by KKHI's Bill Agee.
What describes music? Nothing. Music is an empire for itself. It is the language of the soul. Nobody should ever say, I can't go to a concert, I do not understand. You have nothing to understand when you come to a concert. You have just to be willing to come, to sit down, and you have to be willing to listen. And thus everybody has what we would call an inner voice, and he is silent and listens what this inner voice tells him. When he is willing to listen, he will also hear what great music can tell him.
Thank you very much, Maestro.
And thank you from all of us, Maestro Cripps, for your years here in San Francisco and your gifts of wonderful music making.